great. Okay. Yeah, I can just about. Okay, thanks for inviting me. I thought what I'd do is talk more broadly about some of the conceptual understanding of violence and representations of violence, and then end in, I guess, on a particular slide which deals with the Middle East. And I guess there are a number of questions which I really try to focus on in my work, and these concern what is the relationship between violence and the image. Can an image truly capture the horrors of the human capacity to dehumanize its fellow citizens? Which images provoke us into feeling and action? Why do some images appear intolerable to us? And how might we rethink the power of aesthetics to challenge violence in more critically astute ways? Now let's begin here with two key terms through which this session is framed: violence and the image. Violence, we know, is a complex term that refers to something more than bodily assault. Violence can be something which wounds our very sense of being or inflicts a forced injury upon a life in a way that cuts deeper than any physical laceration. But we also know that violence is often seen as positive and creative. Such, in fact, is the nature of the modern condition, whose very claims to material progress do immense violence to both the present and the past, in order to propel history in a more technologically astute direction. And what of the image? Well, not only have we come to appreciate through the advances in neuroscience how the mind truly is image conscious. Critical philosophers have long since overcome the crude and reductive separations between thought and worldly representations. To think is always to conjure an image of thought. Indeed, not only have we come to appreciate our power continually operates through discursive and aesthetic regimes of truth. It is important to recognize politics is aesthetic in so much as it is driven by competing visions of our subjective world. These basic premises alone bring us to an important point in our critical analysis. If we accept politics is aesthetic and that violence is a condition of possibility for political rule, it necessarily follows that any inquiry into our terms of engagement should not simply focus upon images of violence. We know there are images that depict violence and brutal scenes. Nobody doubts the existence of these, although the subjective nature on the scale or the extremity of the violence being depicted in actual compositions may often be brought into question. But if we accept that images function in a political way, that is to say, the image itself is a form of political intervention, affecting the human senses and often preceding the written or spoken word, there is a need to move away from addressing which images are violent and critically question instead the violence of the image. It is my contention that every single image reveals a certain violence. It all depends on how we ethically and politically connect to the image, along with understanding the broader aesthetic regime of truth into which the image is situated. Let's begin with another obvious example here: the work of Francisco de Goya and his Great Deeds Against the Dead from the Disasters of War series. As Jake Chapman observed, who's done a wonderful reworking of Goya's work, it is with this work that Nietzsche's claim about the so-called death of God was given its most potent aesthetic treatment. As Chapman explained, this image was a massive act of violence upon the world, but Goya understands the resonances and the theological resonances which carry over into the modern period. Now, we also know that modernity has seen a notable and sometimes welcome shift from the figurative towards the abstract. Oops, sorry, wrong direction. Nobody understood this better than Francis Bacon and Mark Rothko. Bacon shows us how the lines that define bodies in pain and cuts that precede its embodiments actually precede any physical representation. What Bacon masters is to make the invisible visible through acts of its movement. What is more, with Bacon, we see how the image also connects with a futurity. We scream at the moment when the potentiality for something terrible to happen is about to be realised. In other words, we always scream at the violence to come. Whereas Mark Rothko's landscapes and immersive forms of expressionism opened us up to the raw realities of suffering and the intimate depths of pain and despair. But might we not even need to take this a stage further What might it mean, for example, to include a painting like this, arguably one of the most peaceful and serene compositions ever painted, and feature in an exhibition entitled The Violence of the Image? What if we simply created a fictional narrative which suggested that beneath the water lilies laid the wretched corpses of all those who needlessly suffered at the hands of colonial persecution? Or to paraphrase Brecht, and how much violence was committed so that you might gaze upon this image of tranquility, openly acknowledged to have more value than the ordinary lives of millions, sold on the international market to feed the material desires of those with excess capital, and now sat like some pacifying force for those who would tell you art is merely some cultural pastime. So where does this all leave us in terms of thinking about representations of violence today? I would like to conclude and turn to this image of war-torn Afghanistan to offer just some concluding thoughts. Whilst there is no explicit violence on display in this image, in the sense of representing actually bodily assault upon persons, it doesn't require too much of a leap of the political imagination to recognise the multiple forms of violence at work here, from the gendered, the infanticide, onto the violence of poverty and underdevelopment. Now, every image, as I suggested, invites us into a conversation born of the feelings it produces within us. But what conversation might we have with this image? We might feel nothing and therefore look away, and in doing so reveal through our very denials and withdrawals how there is no such thing as a passive witness when it comes to violence. But what does it mean to engage with these figures in the centre of this composition? In order to put ourselves into this scene, are we not compelled to open ourselves to relations of power and violence? To be invited into the conversation means to partake in the conditions which gave rise to what J.G. Ballard called the atrocity exhibition. Now, there are four just brief final points I'd like to make when thinking about the politics of aesthetics. First, the real terror as seen in images like this often works through absence and assumption. The figure of the oppressed woman is such that even her screams are denied. She suffers behind the veil of silence. Two, the child is not incidental to this composition. With the scream denied, it is the body of the child instead which represents the future. Or to put it another way, the inclusion of the child leaves us in no doubt that the violence is reproductive. Three, we should also lose sight of the importance here of what I have termed in my work the ecology of violence. We can often focus on the two figures in the composition, but forget the actual background setting. There is, in fact, a notable environmental framing to this composition, wherein the inhospitability of the landscape often translates into the inhospitability of peoples. And fourth and finally, moving forward, it is clear that we need much better aesthetic practices when it comes to representations of violence. Such approaches demand taking the power of the arts much more seriously. After all, is there a more compelling reason to write than to feel the beauty and pain of the world? Thank you.
I'm going to take it from very insightful presentation into a kind of like a different theme. And as a journalist and as an academic who teaches journalism, I would like to focus on the ethics of actually showing violent images on TV news. And the main question that has been going on for a long time in relation to broadcasting graphic images of violence in covering wars and conflicts, if it was internal or external conflict, is the question, should we actually broadcast graphic images of violence on our TV screens, part of our news coverage? And there are differences in different countries. In Britain, for instance, broadcast is regulated, so it means that there are certain images that cannot go on TV screens before a certain time, which is 9 o'clock. And even after 9, broadcasters usually tend not to present their audiences with graphic images of audience because they believe, because of research that has been done, that it causes distress to their audiences. On Arab screens, for instance, where I come from, I'm originally from Lebanon, images of graphic images of violence and covering conflict, if it is internal or regional, is evident. So there's no kind of limitation to what type of graphic images that we actually show on our screens. And that has led in many occasions to audiences being traumatized. The latest study that one of my friends did in Lebanon, for instance, with 200 students from A-level schools showed that almost, actually more than a third of those 16 to 17-year-old feel that they are afraid that they are going to get the same fate as those people that they show their bodies or they see their bodies on news. They also feel that they are afraid that they will lose one of their parents to the conflict in a way or another. And those images of violence that they see on a daily basis, and in Lebanon we're talking about not just the images of victims of car bombs that was taking place for a period of time, committed mainly by ISIS, but also images of graphic images of violence that is coming from Syria, and before that from Palestine. So again, that brings a question of ethics. What should we include? What should we keep out? There has been a long kind of like debate on the fact that if we show too much graphic images of violence, we actually sanitize the audiences so they don't really kind of interact or stand up for, you know, to stop what is happening. They stop feeling towards what they are actually seeing, and they would see it as normal. And that again comes in the results of the study that I mentioned. Within those 200 Lebanese students, actually almost 78% of them felt that war is a solution to change, which again is a very distressing fact. But on the other hand, I had an experience with being a journalist covering a certain, the 1996 Israeli assault against Lebanon, where I covered Qana massacre, the first Qana massacre, and I actually, as a broadcaster, as a journalist, broadcasted the most violent, the most graphically violent images of victims on national TV. I was asked 20 years later, would I actually show those images again? And I said yes, simply because those images changed the way the war was actually going on. And it was those images were actually used to stop the Israeli assault against Lebanon. So 5 or 6 days after the Qana massacre, the Israelis decided or agreed to, you know, negotiate a ceasefire to the assault. And for me, that was one of the reasons that, you know, that kind of agreement on a ceasefire was achieved was because of the images of the victims of Qana massacre. What I would say now is that I would not kind of like reuse those images, because what we did is we exploited the images to the point where we were showing them 24/7 for weeks. And then later, you know, a year later, you know, studies started showing that children were actually traumatized by those images for a period of time. So I would show those images on the day because they really made kind of like an impact on the way the war was actually going. But at the same time, I would not kind of like exploit using those messages, those images again and again and again. And I would end with something that Barbie Zelizer, a professor of journalism at Penn School of Journalism in the States, she said, I think most journalists need to keep in mind the question, which is, Are these images actually necessary for your story? Do they add something to your story? If not, don't use them. If they do, use them.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, I mean, it's interesting talking about the case of Kana, because as you said, images may have contributed to action, but today, unfortunately, I don't see this dynamic playing out in Syria, for example. So we have so many images of violence that have been broadcast over the last 7 years about Syria, such as the famous image of the child whose body was found on the beach, if you remember, a few years ago, Aylan Kurdi. That caused moral outrage, but it did not cause a change in policy. It did not push for governments to seek a settlement to the conflict. And today, you know, we're having this meeting while Eastern Ghouta is making headline news because it's under heavy bombardment by the Syrian regime and hundreds of people are being killed. Maybe some of you may remember that this is not the bloodiest incident that Ghouta has witnessed. Ghouta was attacked through chemical weapons very early on in the conflict, and that did not result in, again, a change in policy, despite UN reports, verifying that chemical weapons were indeed used in Ghouta a few years ago. So all this reporting of violence in the media will not necessarily lead to a change in policy. And at the same time, what Zahira mentioned about desensitization, I will take it a step further and say that when it comes to the Middle East in particular, this region of the world has unfortunately become so associated with violence that violence becomes normalized when it comes to the Middle East. It's as if people expect violence when they hear Middle East, so that the kind of shock kind of potential is much reduced. At the same time, I want to just follow up on something you mentioned, Brad, which is about violence that may not seem apparent in certain images. And this reminded me of authoritarian states in the Middle East that often use images as a way to oppress their people and kind of make them fall in line with the state kind of with state policy or the state line on whatever, without using what we normally would refer to as violence. And so, for example, images of leaders that are displayed prominently, you know, in public space. For me, this is about disciplining the citizen and reminding them of who is actually in charge. The murals, billboards, all kinds of visual representations of state authority and state presence. Not even, you know, as I said, it could be just an image of a leader. All these are, for me, indirect ways of expressing the violence of the state towards its people in public space. And I will end by just referring to what happened yesterday, which is that UNICEF, the UN agency, for the first time in its history, issued a blank statement about what's happening in Eastern Ghouta in Syria. And the blank statement was a statement that had quotation marks and punctuation, but without any text. And the message behind this was there are no words left to describe what is happening in Syria today. Those who are tracking the Syrian conflict will know that UNICEF, as well as other UN agencies, have been issuing regular reports about what's happening in Syria over the last 7 years. And as I said, not much has changed. And so, to me, this kind of blank statement, again, is yet another indirect representation of violence, you know, to say no words can anymore express what is happening. But at the same time, as someone who works in policy, it also makes me question why do we have the UN in the first place? If the UN is now kind of pushed to producing symbolic statements that perhaps, you know, go back to the kinds of aesthetics that Brad was talking about, which you might expect from art, but not from the United Nations, you know, as an international organization that's supposed to actually play a hands-on, pragmatic role, you know, in conflicts in the world. So I think when it comes to representations of violence, we need to go beyond the idea of just talking about graphic, physical violence. Violence can manifest itself in many ways. And the ramifications of this representation, whether it's direct or indirect, as I have presented, definitely go very deep, especially in the context of the Middle East. Brad, I wondered, you know, what you thought about some of these issues, especially the issue of the state that lurks behind, even if it's a representation of, you know, something that may appear benign. Mm-hmm. Would you agree that there's violence lurking beneath the surface? Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. So there's a whole number of points, actually. I think, you know, the... I think, you know, like Jacques Lacan talks about, you know, the symbolic order of things, right? And the representation of the symbolic order is often invested and embodied actually in figures and the figurative in the context of, like, the representation of authoritarian leaders, but also, not, you know, even Donald Trump, right? There's kind of these representations of these figures which have a certain masculinity, militarization, which is actually quite explicit in the violence, actually. The, you know, you only have to look at a different angle of vision in terms of the display of military power and all the phallic symbolism which kind of goes with it in terms of gendered politics, I think, is very clear as well. I do also think that there's a number of points I want to talk about, also what you've mentioned. I think it's, you know, you're right in terms of... I often struggle with this myself when you teach, about how do you teach about, you know, questions around violence without not becoming parasitic to images, without even yourself kind of profiting in terms of their representation. And I often find if I give the same lecture two or three times, I can't do it again because you feel like you are normalising it through repetition. And I think this is a really important point in terms of thinking about, you know, our own ethical practices in terms of dealing with representations of violence. How do we not become complicit ourselves in the normalisation? Because violence should never be normal, right? It should never be normalised. And I think this is a real important point to try to keep hold of then, this question of, you know, of how do we not make sure that violence doesn't become normalised? But we also know it's the normalised violence which is the most difficult to critique. And I think that there's something really, you know, and interesting. The other point I do want to think, I don't think there's an exact formula, however, to kind of say, okay, you know, we can say, okay, there's an exact formula in terms of exposing too much representation or too little representation. I think the case of Ali Enkirdi is kind of important. I think the reason why Ali Enkirdi, of course, impacted so much, on the one hand, there was a clear breaking of the taboo about the showing of a representation of a child, right? And that goes back to Nickert's photograph in Vietnam, because after that, Western medias didn't really show, you know, children being, you know, in serious pain or killed. And I think the media kind of broke something there, or perhaps they had no option but to show that image. But yet again, Ali Enkirdi looked very much like a European child. And I think the way it was represented, so I do think there was a racial politics at work in terms of the representation of Ali, which had an impact. So I do think, but I also do think in terms of Western media, in terms of, whilst I get your point about, you know, the media in your country, but in Western media, I think we are actually sanitized in terms of our representations of violence. I don't think we see enough violence in terms of exposure to the raw realities of war and suffering, especially in the context of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we didn't expose. And I think, you know, what we often find actually is it's very easy to use an image to mobilize the cause for further war, but to mobilise an image for the cause for peace is far more difficult. And I think that's, you know, perhaps the challenge that we face. And you talk about, like, the UN Security Council. You walk past the UN Security Council and there's Picasso's Guernica on the wall. Right? And how many times has that Security Council authored the bombing of people when Picasso paints Guernica as a memory such that these things would never happen again? And I think that is, you know, that's a tragic irony in terms of the way art depicts and reproduces itself in the realities of violence.
Yeah, I mean, here, I want to get your thoughts, Dahila, but I just have a footnote about your last point on Guernica versus the Security Council. Sometimes, unfortunately, war is necessary. sometimes military intervention is necessary to stop more violence. So in some ways, I don't necessarily see a contradiction between Guernica and the UN Security Council authorizing a military intervention in a certain country. But what I do see is a contradiction between Guernica and the impotence of the UN when it comes to conflicts that could have been settled through, for example, political settlement, and that are not. So I mean, personally, I do not pursue an idealistically pacifist line, I'm afraid, maybe because I work in policy. Mm. And, some of you may disagree, and that is fine.
I think I have to disagree.
I have to disagree as well.
Because we've seen those military interventions where they have actually led us, or what they have led us to. But I agree with Brad in a sense that, as I said, in Britain, for instance, TV is regulated. TV, as a broadcast medium, is regulated. So there are certain rules that broadcasters need to abide by, including showing graphic images before 9 o'clock. But also, it's kind of like it's seen as by broadcasters as a distasteful thing to show images of graphic violence on screen. And they always talk about what actually research has been done about what audiences feel that is kind of like causes or distasteful for them to watch. But I was at Cardiff School of Journalism in 2003, and we did a huge study on the embed experience of embed journalists covering the Iraq War. And part of that study, focus groups were actually conducted with across Britain with audiences. And the main thing that came out of that is people actually wanted to see what was the impact of war on Iraqis. Because at that time, Al Jazeera was, Jazeera Arabic at that time, was actually kind of like doing or filling in that gap in the coverage. And they could see those images as exclusive from Al Jazeera Arabic coming on international news screens rather than the British ones. So they really wanted to see what was the impact of that missile that they watch on British news, either going out or just the scene of the flames. They wanted to know, they wanted to see images of what was the impact of that missile when it hit the supposed target that it hit. So I agree that sometimes we kind of like underestimate how much people can actually kind of like tolerate in the context of they really need to understand. And one way to make it kind of like understandable to them is to sometimes shock them with images to the point of being graphic is then a debatable question. Alan Kurdi's image, it did not actually, it wasn't something that a decision was made to publish it or broadcast it. It wasn't an easy decision. Mm. And you could see in different newspapers in this country, they show different versions of the image. Mm. So one version is that one version of it is that you did not actually see the face of the child. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the Independent is the only newspaper that actually showed the image as a whole. So again, there was a very kind of like long debate among journalists in newsrooms as to do we use this image or we don't use it. But I also have to say that I agree with you that Alan Kurdi's image has actually, it made a difference in a sense, not in policies, we're not talking policy, but it made a difference in the way people are perceiving the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. And studies that looked into how social media reacted to Alan Kurdi's image shows that people, the way the discourses that people are using or were using on social media after the publishing of Alan Kurdi's image has actually changed to become more positive. So the kind of like negative connotations that was given to the refugees lessened in a way. We have to admit that come Paris attacks in November 15, I think, it changed
again
the story, because part of the media coverage of that event was the fact that there were kind of like news coming in saying that some of the perpetrators of those attacks were actually refugees who managed to, you know, get through to France and commit those atrocities. So the perception of refugee crisis again shifted in the other direction, which kind of like give you also an indication of how images can change people's perception. And images in this sense has also to do with the way we use discourses, the way we report basically on certain events, changes people's perception of what is happening.
Yeah. Now, before anyone thinks I'm a warmonger, just to give you an example of what I mean, I'm not sure what you think, but personally, I don't think that Nazi Germany could have been stopped in any other way, you know, than what happened, which is basically a military intervention, you know, by the Allies against the Axis. So there are cases in history where, you know, you're pushed, you have no choice. But what you're talking about is things like Iraq, for instance. And here I want to relate it to what you're saying, which is the idea of images changing perceptions. So with Iraq, we had an interesting case, and many of you will remember this, of fabrication of images that were presented by the US government in order to justify an illegal military intervention. Meanwhile, people in this country and many other countries marched publicly against this kind of military intervention, but they were not listened to by their governments. And unfortunately today, the change of sentiment, even though it was short-lived, about refugees, for example, sadly did not result in a change in policy, despite many public campaigns by, you know, on social media as well as by NGOs. Tomorrow there's supposed to be a rally in London about Ghouta. I personally don't think that this will suddenly make the Foreign Office go, oh, actually we need to take the lead and try to find a political settlement in Syria, unfortunately. So here we hit something completely different, which is the disconnect between public action and public perceptions and sentiment and policymakers, which is a brick wall that, you know, even someone like myself, I work in a think tank, you know, we deal with policymakers all the time, even, you know, we don't sadly have an answer for. But, yeah, please.
Yeah. I get this argument about, you know, could non-violence have stopped Nazi Germany? Now, there are examples, actually, of non-violence working very effectively, for instance, in Denmark. But it all depends in terms of the time we come into this question, right? If you say, well, 1943, could non-violence have stopped Nazi Germany? No, but non-violence wouldn't have stopped Britain carpet bombing Dresden or all these, you know, the war was at such a suicidal state in 1943. Could non-violence have stopped Nazi Germany just after World War II with a just fair settlement of the Treaty of Versailles? Absolutely, right? So I think the politics in which we come in and give peace a chance, actually. So war is never necessary or was never inevitable. I think it depends in the history where we come in and do a just and fair settlement for people. So I don't think, and I'm always reminded by Franz Fanon's work, and Fanon says, you know, what type of people do you produce through violence? Well, violent people, right? So never be, so why do we expect that people will somehow suddenly come back and you have a blowback with the violence such as ISIS and whatever else? Well, you know, there's a history to this. And I think we have to kind of understand that. So, yeah, so I think that point about, you know, war as being inevitable and we have to do it. And also, I don't like this separation, actually, between people thinking and doing political interventions and policy, right? What we're talking about is political action. And how do we act upon the world in a way that we hope will change it for more peaceful outcomes? And I don't see a separation then between politics and the arts or whatever else. I think we need to find more peaceful solutions in all those fields of political activity, because to me they're not separate, they all infuse one another. So.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I did publish a book a few years ago in which I basically called Image Politics, in which I argue, as you said, there's no separation. However, I must say, working in policy, it's slightly different. No, I understand. Slightly different. On a practical level, mm-hmm. unfortunately, as much as I, you know, would love it, you know, if policymakers actually took into account our conversation here, mm-hmm. sadly they don't. And this, you know, again, as a whole, you know, now the conversation is veering in a different direction. Again, Brexit, for example, lots of people expressed very strong sentiments against Brexit, and yet on the day, these people did not vote. The young people, mainly, who you know, were against Brexit, most of them, it seems, stayed at home, because the demographics show that most people who actually voted for Brexit were over the age of 50. And so the turnout amongst the people who we can assume are most active on social media was actually very low. And this leads me to the next question about images, which is sometimes, Zahira, what do you think? Sometimes might it be the case that there's a kind of sublimation or images kind of being used as a way to make oneself feel better if someone comments about Aylan Kurdi or whatever, but actually could they actually have the opposite effect when it comes to making people want to actually act?
It does, because what we've witnessed after Aylan Kurdi's image was published is a wave of volunteers that actually from Britain went to Greece and Italy and Spain and started helping refugees when they actually arrive on shores. And also it was kind of like interpreted in a wave of volunteers going to the Calais camp before they dismantled it to help the refugee children. And we believe that was part of it. I don't want to give the media that power, but part of it was that, you know, the Aylan Kurdi's image has actually made an impact, you know, on the way, on political activism, on social activism, on people who wanted, actually, I don't care what my government is doing. I want to kind of like go there and do something about it. And I think in that sense, it kind of like mirrors what you're saying. It matters. Mm. So, yes.
Yeah. So on a positive note, even if things don't change at the policy level, we should not dismiss even individual action, because it matters. And this is the other thing, which is, you know, people assume, if I do something, then I'm only one individual and it's not going to make much difference, so why bother? Whereas what you're saying is the cumulative impact can actually be quite significant. Mm-hmm. On that hopefully more positive note, I think people might want to participate in this conversation with questions or even comments. So the floor is now yours. Yes.
Regarding images changing people's perceptions, I'd argue that probably the most widespread and circulated images of violence are fictional representations of violence in the form of films, video games. How would you think these fictional representations feed or interact with people's perceptions of violence?
Oh, don't let me start. Because there's kind of like studies that say they actually influence people. You know, kind of reaction to violence, and other studies that say no, it has no, you know, that kind of, you know, psychological impact on. But there was, and actually took part in a special report that Channel 4 did, and part of that report was actually looking into video games. I think it's auto theft.
Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft. Yes. Yeah. You know. And ISIS videos. Mm. Mm. And there's so much similarity in the setting of the videos, in the sense how, you know, where the filming, the framing of the battles, you know, the setting of the battles. And it's just, it mirrors with certain, you know, storylines in certain video games. Mm. And it, you know, New York Times did a story once about how obsessive are. It actually called it the jihadi tourism in North Syria, mm-hmm. where jihadis were coming from mainly former Soviet Unions, for jihadi tourism, and part of that tourism was playing video games. It was, they would stay, they're eating shawarma sandwiches and playing video games. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, and that again, I don't, it's not conspiracy theory as such, okay, even though I have a tendency to kind of, but the Tunisia attack, the beach attack, again, it was mirrored in one of, I think it's Auto Theft 5. The same scenario where he's taking his gun out of the parasol and then started shooting people on the beach. The same scenario is in the video game. So you figure it out then.
Yeah.
I look at America and I try to work out what's fictional and what's real anymore. But I think that separation between politics and culture is so, as you say, there's no clear separation, right? So, I think this works in the negative ways, but also positively in terms of, you know, it's well documented that, you know, the HBO series Generation Kill had a real big impact over the US imaginary around the, you know, the wars in Iraq, right? So there was a clear, so I think culture can, again, it's not formulaic, but it can have unintended consequences in terms of getting people to engage. And also, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that, you know, for the vast majority of people, their exposure to war is when they come home from work. They don't want to switch on the news. They don't want to, you know, watch the horror stories. But they will happily watch these programs, and they do influence people's sense and perception of the world, rightly or wrongly. And we can't ignore that. And I think we need to recognise then that, you know, these cultural producers are political authors, and they're political actors in their own right. And it was interesting. I did an interview with Oliver Stone recently, and he was talking about the difference in impact in the US Academy and also in US society between Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, where Platoon was everybody, you know, he got massive support from the US government. He could use all their planes. Why? Because Platoon was a recruitment tool, right? Everybody wanted to sign up for the US military after watching Platoon. Nobody wanted to see Tom Cruise castrated in a wheelchair. So Born on the 4th of July bombed, right? And the American public didn't want to see that. And I think that's the way in which, you know, even the same director has very different experiences in terms of the cultural productions that he wants to do. And I think that's quite an interesting way of thinking about the politics of those engagements.
Yeah, just to add a footnote, just a note of caution. You know, you obviously know all the theories on media effects. We should qualify it slightly, you know, related back to your question. I think these violent representations that ISIS has adopted, for example, are more about using these mainstream cultural references like video games and films as inspiration for representing violence, but not for engaging in violence. Meaning, ISIS was going to be violent anyway, and it's going to try to recruit in any way it can. And the people who are attracted by these ISIS-produced videos, basically, they are prone to engaging in violence anyway, and this was just the way to attract them. But it could have been something else. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that they necessarily saw these images and thought, oh, actually, I think engaging in violence would be a great idea. I think there's a lot more going on in someone's psyche to make these images actually appealing. So what I'm saying is, it's not like a pressing a button, you see this image and suddenly, because otherwise, you know, all of us are exposed to these kinds of images.
No, of course, and they how have come, to have something wrong with them.
Exactly, so just to qualify it slightly, it's you know, obviously,
no,
media,
but,
yeah.
I do think that I agree with you, but I also think, like, ISIS is clearly a fascist organisation, right? So, and I think if we understand them at the level of their aesthetics, there's, you're right, you know, the way you sometimes look at the representations of ISIS, and it looks like a Mad Max movie, right? The way in which they play to this, and the use of the desert in particular, actually, is quite extraordinary, the way they use that. But also, I do think there's an important shift with ISIS as well, where we know the horrifying violence of 9/11, which is arguably the most famous representation of violence for our generation, at least. And it has this kind of spectacular. But what ISIS do is they shift the terrain to the intimate. And I think what ISIS have really shown is the levels of our tolerability when ISIS are very clear about the people they're sacrificing. And not many of them are students. Soldiers in their videos, right? It's the homosexual, or it's the aid worker, it's the journalist. And in that sense, they put a hyper-emphasis on the subjectivities they are killing. And I think that's, and also targeting liberal populations, particularly in Paris, you know, precisely those people would more than likely be on the streets protesting against war. Mm. And I think that's a big shift as well in the narrative around why would you consciously target people who are more than likely to resist war? And I think that's an important shift in their violence as well.
Yeah, and on that note, I think what ISIS intended to do is radicalize people against them, because this is part of their narrative.
Yeah.
Their narrative is about supposedly protecting Islamic land from mainly Western intervention. So they wanted to call for violence, you know, at all levels, with them and against them. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of ideal, between quotation marks, society that they were trying to kind of cultivate. Any other...
But can I just say
something? Yes,
of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I also think you can take it further, mm-hmm. and I think those acts of violence were also used as recruiting
of course
tool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
You know, by kind of like make mm-hmm. the, you know, liberal community of people in Paris who would, mm-hmm. you know, stand against the war, for instance... that will kind of generate hate against the larger community as the, you know, Muslim community in France. And by that, you're isolating those kind of like member of those of the communities, of the Muslim communities in France. And by that, you're actually making them more vulnerable to become, you know, for ISIS to recruit them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is where my conspiracy theory always comes in. It's just taking it, you know, kind of like...
Yeah, I agree. Any other questions or comments from the floor? Yes, Dina.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, thank you very much. Very interesting. I was talking today about political communications and aesthetics. But also, I wanted to ask a question about affect. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know there is this whole debate around emotions and affect, and you mentioned something around neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate a bit on that? I mean, have the, you know, I think, you know, the social sciences, the humanities seem to be working at one level, and then we have the neuroscientists trying to understand
mm-hmm.
how the brain works
mm-hmm.
in terms of the action
mm-hmm.
responses. So I just wanted to
mm-hmm.
kind of ask you further on that,
mm-hmm.
whether you know of any type of work where the, you know, neuroscientists have been able to find something in the brain or
mm-hmm.
Communications
mm-hmm.
in the brain
mm-hmm.
That can perhaps provoke certain reactions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the concept of effect is, you know, is crucial in terms of understanding relationships to aesthetics, and particularly Brian Massumi's work is phenomenal in terms of dealing with that crossover between philosophy and neuroscience, and also actually Erin Manning's work, who also connects it to autism as well, and that question of affective relationship to imagery. Now, thinking about World War II, one of the disastrous casualties of our outcome of thinking about World War II was this argument that basically emotion is simply dangerous. Right, so we have to basically strip emotion away from politics, and we need just reasoned, rational, calculated thinking, which we know always authors the greater forms of violence, because sometimes the greatest form of violence is the most reasoned, rationalized, calculated, stripped of emotion. So I think, you know, the moment we lose sight that human beings are emotional creatures is the moment that we give up something politically. And I think because that's also the terrain where we find empathy, where we find feeling, where we find compassion, where we find love. So to give up on that affective dimension to politics, I think, has been disastrous. Now, images affect. That's what they do, right? They have an affective dimension. And like Alan Badiou says about 9/11, everywhere there was an evidence of affect, even if you stopped, said, well, actually, they just deserve this. So, and I think that's what, you know, what we need perhaps to have a better understanding and not actually allow people to become too dictatorial by the scientific model, is to understand the ways in which the brain does function in terms of its responsiveness to representations of violence, but how are we going to harness that potential to steer history in a different direction and to use affect as an affirmative category in rethinking politics, rather than just simply saying emotion is dangerous, because I think that takes us nowhere. So,
yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Works on
mm-hmm.
Twitter.
Okay.
I think that mm-hmm. the social media used by, I think, in Iran and other places, and
okay.
the government is have mm-hmm. the Twitter hashtags. There's mm-hmm. through her interrogation of the people.
Mm-hmm.
They can create, quote unquote, what she calls
mm-hmm.
effective puppets.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and I think it's also to be mindful of the dangers, right? Because, you know, like Walter Benjamin says, you know, about fascism. Fascism reduces politics to pure aesthetics, right? So you have to be kind of mindful of that as well. And, you know, and also, you know, what is Trump's Twitter if not pure affect? Right? It's all about affect. It's all about, I'm just, you know, I'm going to stop you from thinking. If you feel angry, great, I'll mobilise your anger. And you know, there's no greater mobilisation for anger. Who knew Twitter would become so politically popular, right?
So. Yeah, on that note, you could say the same about ISIS.
Absolutely. It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Stopping people from thinking and mobilizing them
mm-hmm.
as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Any more comments? Last opportunity to ask something or say something, and feel free to be provocative.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've been thinking about a lot as you were speaking. Black struggles have often emphasized the violence of images coming since the transatlantic slave trade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how detrimental these images have been to black struggles more generally. So I wondered what you think could be learned from black struggles if we want to think about crises across the Middle East and North Africa.
Mm. But this way also we're talking about violence and resistance, not just
mm-hmm.
We've been talking a lot about oppression and kind of
mm-hmm.
rallying people to violence in a kind of negative way,
mm-hmm.
but how about mm-hmm. we end this by flipping it
mm-hmm.
violence and resistance this time.
Mm-hmm.
Zahira may have a few things to say on that topic.
Yeah, it just takes me to one of the things that I worked on in my first book, which how actually the resistance movement in Lebanon used video in order to portray their ability to defeat the enemy through actually embedding a cameraman with every military operation that the Islamic resistance, which is Hezbollah in Lebanon, was actually operating against the Israeli occupation in South Lebanon. So in that sense, those images of, bombing a military post, showing Israeli soldiers dead, it was a kind of like manifestation of first of all, the truth of it, because there was what at that time was known as media traps. So the Israelis had the tendency to deny any casualties. So the resistance at that time had to do this kind of like filming of these images and showing them, on TV, just to say that we have the proof that we actually caused casualties among the enemy's lines. So in that kind of context, it was used to achieve an aim, and that part of that aim is to kind of like delegitimize the Israeli narrative of what was going on, and also to say that army that could not be defeated, which was the main slogan of the Israeli army, is not true. So images of violence in that kind of sense were used to manifest the ability and capability of the resistance movement against the Israeli occupation in South Lebanon to actually achieve the liberation later on in 2000.
I guess just two quick comments. There's when you were speaking, I was kind of reminded of there's a brilliant short interview with Angela Davis, which you can find on YouTube, which is just, it's about Angela Davis violence, and she's basically being quizzed about why she advocates violence, and her response was, "You're asking me about violence," and then she gives this narrative around the lived experience of a black person growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, and which kind of violences are we asking questions about? But I do think there's a second point around this, and again, it brings me to Fanon's work, and of course, Fanon understands aesthetics. Fanon understands poetry, right? So, and also Lewis Gordon's recent book about what Fanon says is brilliant in terms of touching upon this. But I think the important lesson of Fanon is not about why do people resist, but what happens the day after the revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think what Fanon says is if violence becomes the modus operandi for resistance, you will become the thing you most despise. And I think that is the principal lesson of Fanon. So if we're thinking about resistance, we also have to understand that as an affirmative category as well, and something which has a power of aesthetics to it as well. So.
Okay. Well, on that note, thank you very much. And thank you for joining us this evening and to the Mosaic Rooms for hosting this conversation tonight. And thanks a lot, Brad and Zahir.
Thanks.